Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
Okay, so just to kind of shoot us out of a cannon, my best friend, and you know what's interesting is I mentioned him on at one of your workshops. We were all talking through different things, and I mentioned that I met my best friend at age 5 on the playground, and when I was kind of estranged from the other kids on account of being a nerd, he you know, came and retrieved me at the, on the playground equipment and brought me in and brought me back into the fold. And ever since then, we've kind of really just always been in each other's lives. Even as we chose very different life paths, you know, I did college, he did the army, and he moved to Oregon and became an accountant. And I stayed in LA and, you know, crashed and burned and then got sober, and all the while pursuing a creative life. And anyway, I felt really helpless the other day because his wife is was pregnant with their third child, and she's just had incredible complications with the pregnancy, and they had to deliver the baby several months, like early, and the baby's in very bad shape, very underweight, and in the NICU, and the wife is in a coma from,
oh my God,
you know, from the bleeding and kind of like all these things that happened. And I was the best man at their wedding, so I know them very well. Obviously, him much more than her, but anyway, I. He called me when I was at a meeting on Friday and kind of gave me the update. And, you know, he's taking leave from work and he's just kind of waiting for news. You know, at last I heard she was being worked on in the hospital. And I think I maybe said like 4 or 5 words. I told him I loved him. That was like the main thing I could offer. I just wish that, like we always do, you know, I wish that I had better advice to give, or I had something to kind of help them. There are some things, some subjects in life where like I cannot really allow myself
it's the bullshit we were talking about before is a form of intelligence and a form of cleverness and all this other stuff. This stuff is like, you know, emphasis on the second syllable. My sentences end before they get to the end. I got nothing. It's like, and it does, and I think it's normal. I think it's normal to feel inadequate. I would think if we were going to interview a bunch of people about situations, how they respond to stuff like that, the people who don't describe feeling a sense of inadequacy are the people we would not particularly like as much as the other people.
I'm looking forward to, I hope that we can continue doing the show for a bit. And I think that lately we have tried to speak to these areas of recovery and emotional sobriety where words fail us, where our bodies fail us. And, you know, and I'm hoping we can get to the flip side of the coin eventually, which is emotional sobriety just as important when we're on top of the world. You know what I mean? When we've got, we've managed to be spin a dozen plates and, you know, try not to let ourselves or the plates fall off and smash. I just happen to be kind of wading through quite a bit of, human misery, I guess, at this point. And it's, you know, we talk about depersonalizing things a lot with emotional sobriety and pushing back against the idea that we're somehow deserving or entitled of special treatment, you know, that like this shouldn't be happening to us, quote unquote. I found myself thinking that a lot yesterday, just about my friend and his wife, about how why did the lightning strike have to happen to them instead of some other assholes that I haven't met that I don't have, that I don't have that kind of especially fond feeling for. People get torn up, you know, it's, and you can't, usually you can't plan for it, you know, or account for it. It just happens. And you've got to like shuffle together your response as best you can, right?
What I don't trust, the people I don't trust are the people who can take something like that and then and explain it. and in a way that makes them feel comfortable. It's like, because I'm going like, that's, I mean, the simplest ones are, are the dumbest ones, which is, God works in mysterious ways. It's like, the only decent response to that is, well, God's an asshole. And he's fucking with us for his own entertainment, probably. Yeah,
Right,
and I
it's
think, and I,
two the two options. It's like if there's a design to this, very scary, and if there's no design, also very scary. It's two flavors of
well, it's if there if there's a, if well, I would say if there's a God, it's either it's incompetence or sadism. I snuck this into my very first book, into Simple Truth. Basically, it's a slam to anybody, any religious view that believes they know what God is, and what it is. What I was, because my point is, I do kind of a logical little thing there, which is, I was listening to my clients' gods, and they were either incompetent, or in my view, they're incompetent or assholes. And that, two things. One is, for my own integrity, even if their asshole God was really God, I would like to think I have enough integrity to tell him to fuck off. It's just, instead of people go like, oh no, he's so powerful, you're like, oh, so that's why we should worship Hitler. It's like, what the hell?
Right.
It's like, that's just saving our own asses. But then the other piece I put in is very, it's just like 3 pages, but it's like that I thought in terms of, if that's God, then that would make me more qualified and make me a better God than God, because I'm more compassionate than that God. I'm more rational than that God. I'm all these things. And then, of course, the punchline to that is not that I think I'm better than God. Is that I whatever God is, whatever that concept is, I cannot be it. Because the basis of, and this is what I tell people about getting their head around when they get all nervous about the higher power thing in AA, and go, I say, look, the only thing you have to be able to do to say you have a higher power is acknowledge that you're not God. That's it. If you're, if that there is, or that there is a power higher than you. So, what I always use as an example is, if I'm saying that to you, I'm saying, like, you and I together are a power higher, better and smarter and wiser and tougher than either one of our addictions. Okay,
Yes.
one on one, neither of us are. We will fucking lose to, we don't know when, but we will fucking lose that conversation. We'll lose that debate somewhere along the line. We'll lose our place, well, one on one. But all we have to have is that additional person. Now, of course, depth on the bench is good for us to have a community. That's a wonderful thing. But so anyway, the simple truth was that cannot possibly be God, because I cannot possibly be better than God. You have feelings about it. You have thoughts about it. You can make no sense of it. And if I can actually answer that question, don't listen to me, because, I mean, at best, I'm making a guess.
Practicing serenity is change. It also includes, and we're always careful to emphasize this, changing what you can. I think I'm just racking my brain about like some something nice I can do for him. Yeah.
You guys don't remember the days when we got cards and letters in the mail, but getting things in the mail. One of the things during my cancer treatment that my older sister did, she sent me just, good old fashioned Hallmark get well cards, just constantly. And so and to the point where it's like, it was nice when she did it at first, but then it got to be to where I was disappointed if I went to the mailbox and there wasn't one. It's like, I mean, and it was just turned out to be the sweetest. I mean, she stayed in touch with texting and stuff like that too. And it's like, just something like that. I mean, just the idea that you send, something. I was in a conversation last night at dinner, where we were talking about, the lost art of letter writing, and we were talking about how, we hated writing letters. I'm going to get back to what you were saying. I promise it circles around. We would not write letters for, we would postpone letters because we had if you look at old letters, and this person was saying, even if you look back hundred years ago, the same thing. There was this understood preface that you had to do at the beginning of every letter to somebody, and it was the weather, you know, how everybody's doing. You know, it's like the weather here. So many letters just in, the weather here has been horrible. The weather here has been wonderful. Da 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 da. And we were talking about how often, you know, expectations like that would keep us from actually staying in touch with people. And then my friend Bedford Combs, I was working with worked with his codependency treatment program, and he was trained by Sharon Cruz, she and her husband began on site, and he showed me a letter that Sharon had written to him one time, and it was just one page is on, I think, on her letterhead, and it just said, "I just wanted you to know I was thinking of you and I love you," but it was scrawled on the page. I mean, it was took up the whole page. You love getting that mail as much as you love getting a goddamn detailed letter about the weather in some other part of the country. It's like, it just says, "I'm here. I'm thinking of you." Do something that you're just being consistent with, or just you're just there. You know, it's like, I mean, and I say we can't say anything, but we're writers, and we probably can do better than, you know, I mean, it's kind of a writing challenge. What do you say to somebody that you have nothing to, that you have nothing helpful to say? You know, it's like, but just something, maybe just a little note or, you know, just something that just is just kind of constantly. I mean, if you were there, then you would drop by. He would see you on a regular, maybe a daily basis. He would, you know, so whatever version of that you can do that fits for him. Like if somebody were to call me on a regular basis, I would hate it because I don't want to talk on the fucking phone. It's like, but the people who texted me during my treatment and had no expectations, and I never got any implied complaint that I didn't respond in time or something like that. You were one of those people. You would just stay in touch. I mean, I was always hearing from you. It's like that shit makes a bunch of difference. And just because that's all you're saying is, you know, I'm right here.
Well, I'm absolutely going to be doing some of that, and hoping for the best.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's. I had a client that a client's. My client was the woman, but I know all of them now, and their baby was in the NICU, and she came very close to dying at the birth of their, you know, and I've had conversations with the husband about the fact that, you know, he was in that same place your friend is, which is I may lose both of these people, you know. It's like one before I even know them, and the other one is my partner. It's like, I mean, yeah, I mean, you see how, notice that I go without words as soon as I get to that place. I mean, it's like you just walk up to the cliff and you look over and go, I got nowhere else to go from here. It's like, because we have no experience with that. We are literally at a loss for words, for anything. It's like everything that feels like we could do seems to be inadequate, you know, and it is inadequate to the point what we would, you know, from our point of view, that could I do something that could actually help? Because we feel helpless, you know. But if you talk to the people that we connect, you know, and or people like me on this case, or you've done it too with falling off the damn mountain, it's like, you know, if you want to know whether what you're doing is helpful, ask the person that you gave it to, you know, because ultimately your friend is going to say whatever you choose to do when he's telling this story down the line. You'll be in that category of some people who did things that helped. You know, just I'm right here. I love you. You know, I mean, hell, could you get enough at a time like that? Could you get enough notes in the mail that just said I still love you? It's like you know, you guys have known each other for almost forever.
Yeah, and I don't know. He's always made time for me, no matter how far across the far flung corners of the globe we happen to be on. You know, I always seem to be in his thoughts Well, some time or another.
He made time for you at the very beginning. I mean, I love that story. I mean, how old were you?
Five.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just the nature of the person. It's like nobody's, he's not learned that at all. That's how he came to this planet, to have that kind of heart to see you over there. And I can identify that, because that's who I felt like I was as well. It's like to literally come get you, Yeah, I mean, I understand your motivation for wanting to be there for that guy, because I mean, you know, it's 5 years old. That's one of those places where you may say, if we were playing with just playing with how time works, there's a split in the road, and you know, had he not come over and gotten you, it's easy to, if we're just talking as writers, we could just go like, this is a different story.
Yeah,
you know. It's a whole different story. That little 5-year-old toddles over, his little short little 5-year-old legs, and she sees you and connects you and brings you back.
Mm.
And here you are.
He sure did. Shout out to Marty and Justine, and hoping for her swift recovery and the babies.
Absolutely.
Baby Grace.
Grace.
Yeah. Beautiful name, huh?
Well, perfect name for the situation.
Yeah, I think so too. What's going on in Tom world?
Still procrastinating,
hell yeah.
I'm learning to accept that more and more. I think that I just it's not that I don't get things done, because I do. I'm sitting here in my writing office. I can look up over here, and I friend of mine was a writer. He did this, and so I'm imitated him, and I have all of my book, every book I've ever written, I have the cover up on framed up on the wall, so I can look at those. When I think I've accomplished nothing, then I can look up on the wall and I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I got 10 book covers on the wall. It's like I've got some other books that are e-books and things like that aren't up there. But so I can't say, so it's, you know, in my challenge to myself in my recovery is basically the tough loving parent in me, you know, says, no, you can't sit there and say you haven't accomplished anything, Tom. That's not fair. That's not accurate. It's not even sane. You know, you have done that. So, it's helped me balance out the idea and what I've learned is, you know, and certainly you're part of that support system, that I've learned that I'm far from alone in being a procrastinator, and specifically with other creative people, I find that I would guess it's the norm rather than the exception, wouldn't you? Are going to identify with that if you describe it, and you know, putting off stuff or like what you and I've talked about is, you know, I'll still do something creative, but I will immediately avoid the thing that would be the smartest for me to be doing.
What have you learned about the source of your procrastination over time?
Oh, it's, I think that would take us to my book, Embracing Fear. It's just fear.
Fear.
It's just,
yeah.
That's just fucking fear. It's like, it all comes back down to fear. Everything you can find, you can have every other emotions are genuine. It's like, one of the things I talk about in that book is like, you know, it's not to minimize the power of any of those other emotions, but if you look at them in terms of layers, it's like you get all the way down in there. Any of the emotions that are difficult, I don't say negative emotions, because I think it's a real problem that we have identified in our culture, negative and positive emotions. It's like, it confuses people who are in therapy, for one thing. It's like, because it makes you think that if you're feeling sad or hurt or grief or pain or anger, that you're not doing well. You know, it's like, No, and what we know now, certainly what we do teach in emotional sobriety is congruence, which is no. If you're telling me that you're feeling, I don't care if you're telling me you're feeling jealous and pissed off, and whatever else, and afraid, and you say, so I'm doing bad. You go like, no, did you just tell me the truth about you? If you just told me the best you could do to tell me the truth about how you're feeling, that's what we're working on. And of course, acceptance is what we're talking about. It's just, the acceptance isn't I like it. It's the acceptance is, if we're not accepting, we are postponing. If we're not accepting, we're holding it at bay. If I accept that that's the truth about myself, it's like, and I define my emotional sobriety, or my adultness, my self-responsibility, my self-respect on by congruence. Are my words matching my experience? Am I able to, am I internally denying what I'm experiencing in some way? If that's the case, I need to, that's where the work is. But if I know what it is, and I don't need to share it with everybody in the whole fucking world. There's a difference between secrecy and privacy. I had a eating disorder group years and years ago that they coined the phrase. They would just say, doing good, feeling like shit. And because one time it came from a thing where I was checking in with everybody at the first of a group, and I asked people, and I was asking this one woman, I said, how are you doing? And she said, and just her response, you'll get it immediately, just her question back was totally clarifying. She said, are you asking me how I'm doing or how I'm feeling? I said, okay, both. She was doing really well. She was doing sobriety with her eating disorder was in better shape than it had ever been. She was following her food plan. She was not, she was a purger, and she was not purging, hadn't for a long, several weeks at that time. And she said, I'm doing really well, and I feel like shit. Not only are we doing well and feeling like shit, sometimes we feel like shit because we're doing well.
Here's something I know you'll relate to on some level is my sense of humor, my sense of funny. In a sense, isn't really funny because I think I've always just used it as a literal life-saving mechanism. You can season any experience with a little joke, and it's like that's how you get the pill down, really. I mean, and sometimes it's the only way you get the pill down. And funny doesn't cost anything. And I think, and you know what? I can say that about a sense of humor before I got clean and after. I remember I was working in this office, and it was like an open secret that I was just like loaded all the time or disappearing to go get my fix. And this was one of the this was on the short list of the people I most needed to make amends to once I got sober and started working the steps. I learned later my boss used to call me Houdini because they would turn around and they didn't know where I was. But I honestly like I knew that I was in deep shit while I was working there, and that I was trying everybody's patience. And as you can imagine, I had a lot of intense deficit of like self-esteem, and I knew that I wasn't bringing it. But what did I do? I tried to just make everyone laugh as much as I
You
could.
entertained everyone, yeah.
Yeah, and myself, just kind of like the hearing my la hearing the jokes echo around the walls of the cell, And I don't know. Whatever that all was, it got me it I it allowed me to survive long enough to be able to get sober and make that amends. But yeah, you're super funny, and I imagine that's never left you through this last year of hardship.
Well, it's in and it's because it's you say that, because that was probably one of the things that scared me the most when I first became sober, because I remember thinking and saying to my wife, I don't think I'm ever going to say anything funny ever again. And it's like that was such a part of my identity. And I'm like you. It's always been natural. It's like since I was a little kid. So it's not like something that I, decided one day I'm going to be funny and I try to figure out how to do it. It's just like it's really an integral part of my being. But it really did feel like that was gone. And that talk about scary. That was a scary thing because and it's also one of those places where basically it challenges us to take away just trying to log everything into in the history books of our lives of positive or negative because maybe you could be funny if you didn't grow up in some kind of situation like we grew up with, and not imperfect. I mean, not perfect situations, but not horrible, horrific situations. But the dysfunction we grew up in, it's like that's how we got that way. I just I was talking earlier to you about how I could get away with shit. It's like one of the ways you get away with shit, and you're talking about that in your job, is to be funny. It's like, I mean, I've learned it literally back when I was a performing magician, we talk about, it's not quicker than the eye, it's distraction. And sometimes, if I'm showing you a card trick, then sometimes the distraction is going to be with my hands and with my eyes, and I'm going to get you to look at a place I want you to look. But most of the time, and I was talking, actually, I was at a memorial service yesterday talking to another magician about this, and we had this conversation. Mo how most of the time the distraction is purely mental. It's just I'm talking, and I've got you. I'm giving you things to think about, to think about that are pretty much meaningless is what's happening. It's like, but I'm crowding your brain with things. And that so that you're not even going to have time to try to figure out what it is I'm doing, and I'm going to do it while you're thinking about something else. It's like, and to me, it's one of the most fun parts about performing. And it is, but if you think about it, it's based on deception. As a magician, that's what I do. It's like I always say, here's a question: when is a magician lying? And the answer is when he's talking. It's
Yes,
like.
misdirecting.
He's never telling you the truth, but we got. How grateful are we that we have the sense of humor that we have? It's like if somebody were to say, "Well, we could take you back and give you another. You could grow up in a different way and do different stuff like that." And we go, "No, don't take this away. I'm fine." That's where the idea is, and basically learn from the past, get the hell out of there. Don't go back there. Just stay in the present, keep going, be extremely grateful for what we have, which is for you is includes our humor, but it also includes going back to your friend is it's like it it's just it's your love for your friend and his wife and their children.
If I can make him laugh somehow, that would be like winning the Powerball. All I got to think
It's
about.
it's one of the things. It's one of the things. I don't think I've ever said this out loud, and maybe this sounds egotistical, but it's one of the things that I do. It does make me. It does build some self-esteem. Is that, and you probably get this too. Very often, with somebody's in a very difficult situation, and I don't go in thinking I'm going to make somebody laugh. That's not the you don't do that. It's like but. How many times has somebody said to you, thanks, after a conversation, thanks for making me laugh? It's like, it's a gift that we can do that. It's like, and I can tell a selfish story about that where I had a friend that I was, she and I, my friend Trish, we did group therapy. We were co-therapists, group therapy for 25 years. We did, I mean, back in those days, we did lots of groups. Well, at one point we had six groups a week we were doing. We did lots and lots of group therapy. And we kind of fought like brother and sister and all this other stuff. But we were friends outside of work, but we were really good colleagues. And she died several years ago of that glioblastoma brain tumor thing that John McCain died of. It's like, and the last time we got to get with Dee Dee and I got to go got to see her and to say goodbye. She wasn't able to speak at the time, but she was awake and alert and stuff like that. And one of the things I said when we left, walked out of the time we saw her, I got in the car with Dee Dee, I said, I made her laugh twice. I could see it. She can't make any, she wasn't able to make any sound, but I watched her eyes and I'm like, and I said, I made her laugh twice. And to me, it meant something to me because that was, that's a big part of our relationship. We laughed together. We were able to see the humor in most anything. What's the theme of that? It's Aren't We Cool?
Yeah, I mean, that's my theme every day. I'm rocking it. Yeah.
How am I going to be a groovy dude today? It's like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll offer one other thing. It's a little bit sensitive and embarrassing for me, but maybe it could be of some use to somebody. Is that I chose to have a vasectomy. I got it last week on Wednesday, and I dealt with so much disapproval from my parents for that decision. And in the lead up, I told them at the last possible minute, intuiting somehow, even though we'd really never talked about it in detail, that they would have issues with my decision. And then we embarked upon a several day period of them kind of trying to run mind games on me to try and get me to not to do something else. And I suppose the not taking it personally, the kind of like holding on to yourself, these emotional sobriety tactics, those were like I was deploying those in full force or as much force as I
Oh
could mu
yeah.
muster. And I ended up doing it and everything seems to be going okay. But I think the one thing that I'm glad I handled some of it inelegantly. But I am glad that I made an effort to connect with my parents, to sit and listen to whatever it is they had to say.
Yeah. That took guts.
Well, I didn't want to. I didn't want to hear them out. I don't think they've got any
That's
claim.
why I say it
Yeah.
took guts. It's like, who would want to do
Yeah.
that? That
And like
it was respectful. You did something that was respectful. That's a great example of doing good, feeling bad. It's like, no, I'm doing the right thing. I really hate this, but you did it.
I'm just of course I'm wondering what the long-term ramifications are going to be for my relationship with them, but I also know that like this is as good an example of any of how we are not our parents, and sometimes a fork's gonna we're gonna come upon a fork in the woods, and we're just gonna have to go in a different direction than them, and the relationship must endure that, or it's I guess wait, or maybe I'm not saying it must endure that, but like this is a natural part of anybody in any kind of relationship, is that there's not
Well, if the
always going to
relate if
be yeah.
Yeah, if the relationship's going to endure, then authentically, then basically, it's going to have to include this. I realized as you were telling that story, I was thinking from the empathy for your parents' point of view. It's like, I don't know your parents, so I don't know if this is the case or not. But I thought, well, there's an old guy's going like, well, there's legitimate grief there. There's if whatever grandchildren there are going to be,
Yeah, it is
they grieve
legit.
it,
Yeah.
man. It's yeah. You go like because especially if you're attended, if you're thinking this is sort of likely the road we're on, and this is what will happen in our life development and stuff like that. It's like so. I really like the idea. I really appreciate the idea that you regardless of, how difficult it was for you, that you made the space and the time to talk to them and let them know and hear them out. And I absolutely understand the strategy of not giving them a large head start on that, so they have a lot of time. Because I don't know about you, but I would be afraid that if they had enough time, they would sway my decision, and it wouldn't be my decision.
Or they can pull a Tonya Harding and take out my other knee, keep me from the operating
That's right.
table.
I don't think that crippling you takes you away from the operating table.
Just makes it easier point of entry.
I just think all they gotta do is pick you up and put you on the table. Well, isn't it true that if you really want a decent assessment of our mental health, which is what we're talking about when we say, well, how's your emotional sobriety? It's hindsight that's gonna tell us that.
And also, yeah, I mean, and part of that too is what you were saying before, which is that how you're doing and how you're feeling are
Yeah,
distinct things, right?
it's complicated. It's like, yeah, and the idea is, I put my hand right in front of my face, and I know people are just hearing the audio here, but I've got my hand right over my face, and I'm looking at you on the screen, and my question is, which one of us can describe my hand better? It's like, I can't. I'm blinded by it, and
Right.
you can tell me exactly what my hand looks like on my face because you're looking at it. And so, and ultimately, emotional sobriety is a synonym for being a grown up. It's not a thing unto itself. It's a language, and I love the language of it. I think what we do is it gives us a system in a way of putting this into practice in our lives.
I think that one thing we can do on the pod week to week. Resolve to continue growing up, but to not lose our funny.
Well, if we, yeah, I don't think we will. That's a nice thing.
I can stall for long periods in the growing up part, but the funny will persist.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and the other—that's a really good point, Patrick. This is probably a different subject, but it's like people will say to me, for instance, they'll say, "Oh, your inner child is so apparent," and I don't pull them aside and tell them this, but the truth is, no, that's not my inner child. Everything that's funny and goofy and all this other stuff—it's pure adult. It's definitely, not only do I have a natural ability to do it, but as you do too. I also know how to drive it. I know how to steer it. I know when to put the brakes on. I know when to not do it. I mean, occasionally, and that becomes funny when we actually say something funny that is, at the wrong time. That becomes a joke unto itself. One time, I'll tell a real quick story. One time, I made a miscalculation. I had a client that said to me, "One thing I appreciate about you that I haven't ever seen another therapist is you don't use all that jargon." And so I have a reflex response to that one, which I just immediately reflexed and said, which was, "Oh, that's okay. That was easy because I was drunk during graduate school and I never went to class." It's like I looked up. And this woman was a deer in the headlights. I mean, that was a mistake for me to say that. I for her, I just told her I wasn't trained. It's like,
You know, you could also said, well, how does that make you feel?
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you're with.